Good morning and welcome to California. Highway 101 has taken us south to Los Angeles today to meet one of the political icons of the 1960s. Tom Hayden, who was born in 1939, was one of the signatories in 1962 of the Port Huron Statement, the manifesto of the SDS organization, Students for a Democratic Society. Before that, he'd been a civil rights worker in the American South, a freedom rider attempting to desegregate public transport, who was beaten and arrested in Georgia and Mississippi. He was one of the leaders of the campaign to end the war in Vietnam, and in 1969 would find himself in the dock as one of the Chicago Seven, charged with conspiring to disrupt the Democratic Party's presidential nominating convention in Chicago the previous year. In Mayor Richard Daley's city, in what was later called a police riot, Hayden was one of hundreds of protesters who was beaten and arrested. Later, he would marry and divorce fellow political activist Jane Fonda and begin a long career in California state politics. Tom Hayden, you're very welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Now, pretty much your entire ancestry at the great-grandparent level was Irish, but you weren't brought up in a very Irish-American environment.
No, in the Irish world, I guess I would be called part of the diaspora, but the unconscious, that is, assimilated diaspora. That is, I knew nothing of my past until I was about 30 years old.
Now, you were born in 39, you were a war baby. Do you have actually recollections of the USA during World War II? You would have been very young.
Well, I was a pre-war baby. That was the beginning. I remember sort of sitting on a couch with my mom, and I remember the house being particularly warm and cozy, and she said it was because of Franklin Roosevelt. So I felt entirely safe during this period of war. I didn't feel traumatized, or even when I looked at the sky for Japanese planes, as I was told to do, I really wasn't worried because we had Franklin Roosevelt.
The separation, the divorce of your parents, was that a really traumatic, a bad, bad time for you?
I was 11 when my parents separated. There'd been some violence around the house. I think I was obviously traumatized, but it was on that silent level. You know, this is apparently the way families work out. This is something that's kind of embarrassing and best kept within the home itself. And I think at that time, divorce hadn't become as common as it is today. And so I carried a bit of shame. My father was a good father, and my mother's a good mother, and they saw each other on a weekly basis in order to be supportive of me. They did all the right things that they could. But I don't advise it. I've been through it once or twice myself, and it has unknown effects on kids. And for me, it was the sort of thing that shatters the world. It wasn't the war. It was the divorce.
What was it, do you think, that prompted the student revolt of the early 1960s, in fact, the late 1950s, really? What created that generation of dissenters?
Well, I was part of it. I've studied it. I research it. I've written about it. I teach about it, and I still don't know. What we know that we have in common was a global disenfranchisement of young people. I could not vote. I could be drafted. The youth in Northern Ireland could not vote and were discriminated against. The blacks in the South, the same story. But there was a feeling around the world of disenfranchisement on the part of these young people. Why then? I think is somewhat mysterious. I really do. I mean, I think that you had African decolonization. You had the beginning of the civil rights movement with the Montgomery bus boycott and Rosa Parks. But that was in the area classified as the apathetic 50s. But these were precursors. And then it comes like the wind, and anybody who's been through it will tell you this, that it's mysterious in the sense that no journalist, no historian ever predicts the beginning of a social movement. It's amazing. So suddenly, I was graduating from college in a sea of apathy, and then the next day, thousands and thousands of young black students in the South were marching and going to jail for their rights. Is there a generational factor? I think what's passed on, what's not passed on, the feeling that your parents haven't given you what you had hoped for, there's a bit of generational tension that figures in it. But why Poland, Mexico, Northern Ireland, Southern United States? Why Che Guevara? You know, why Fidel? Why all this happens around 1960s? 1960 is an unknown, and we should be embarrassed, we in academia, for not having a ready explanation.
You were a student journalist at that stage, and on a trip to California in 1960, at the age of 21, you met Bobby Kennedy and you met Martin Luther King.
Well, this year is the 50th year since I enrolled at the University of Michigan, and I was ambitious, extroverted, I guess, smart student, and I loved the Michigan Daily, which was a daily newspaper that I wrote and edited, and it was my real introduction to the world. And in 1960, as you say, I hitchhiked. We don't do that anymore, but I hitchhiked to the Bay Area because I'd heard there was a student movement being born, and I wanted to write about it. And then I flew for the first time to L.A., where I came to the Democratic Convention as an accredited student journalist with the Detroit News. So the Bobby Kennedy story is nothing. I passed him in the hallway. I introduced myself. We talked for a couple of minutes. I grew to know him and respect him and became a friend only 7 years later. But the story about Dr. King is very interesting to me. I was covering the civil rights debate at the convention, and he was picketing outside with some left-wingers and students from the South, and I had my notepad out, and I remember I asked him several questions. What was in my mind was to obtain quotes, which were like the currency of the realm. If I had quotes from Dr. King, I could write an article, and it would be published on the front page of the newspaper. I went away from that encounter with a very strange feeling that he was a kind and a thoughtful man, and he was listening to me and answering questions. He must have done it 1,000 times. And who was I? I was, like, ambitious. I was a careerist. What was I doing? Why wasn't I on the picket line? And it haunted me. He didn't guilt trip me or anything. It just occurred to me that I was snatching words from him for my own use, while he seemed to be giving himself to a larger cause, one that affected him and his family, but more people. And that was, where the seed of activism began to be planted for me. And also there were these students who were my age. Why was I writing about them and getting my bylines when they were sitting in jail? Were they just raw material for my stories? Or were they human beings that I could be like? And why wasn't I? So over time, I've always, whether I've been street politics or electoral politics teaching, I've always thought, for me, the key question is, what goes on in the minds of people who are apathetic or uncertain? And how can we engage, not by oratory or shouting at them or that sort of thing, but remembering that I was once like them and what it took for me to become, you know, fully engaged has always been a guidepost for my activism.
Now, tell me about then your introduction to the rural South during the civil rights campaign of the 60s, because you took those questions that you asked yourself on board. You took those lessons, I suppose, on board. Or you learned some lessons from that.
Well, I went to Georgia. I went to Mississippi. But I went as a writer, and I wrote pamphlets, and I came north and spoke on campuses. And I discovered there was a role for a kind of propagandistic writer, you know, partly nothing but the facts, and partly the moral implications. One day, I was simply asked by the student civil rights group that I was working with, would I go on a freedom ride? They were looking for a couple of white people.
This was desegregating the buses.
What had happened is buses and trains had been, that crossed interstate lines, had been desegregated by an executive order of the Kennedy administration. But it had to be tested. Being legal is one thing, making a difference is another. So I said, sure, not knowing what I was getting into, but I realized, I mean, I'd been covering, I'd seen people with their heads beaten in, I'd seen people on the run, I'd been chased around a couple of times myself. So I think there were 11 of us, and we just took a December 61 train ride to Albany, Georgia, which is about 3 or 4 hours south of Atlanta. And we were met there by the usual greeting party, you know, a mob of people that attacked us, police who saved us, they said, by arresting us, threw us in jail, and that's all I saw of Albany for several days. And then we were bailed out, and lo and behold, we were taken to a church, and I was standing on a stage, and there was Martin Luther King again. I'd gone through my metamorphosis. He didn't even know me, but there was a big rally for the civil rights movement in Albany, Georgia. That, by the way, is where Jimmy Carter comes from. Plains is just down the road. So it's an area that's produced, you know, a lot of significant people.
You were beaten, though, as well. I mean, not beaten by, in that instance, but earlier you had been beaten in Macomb, I think.
I don't need to draw attention to myself. Many, many people were beaten bloody. But I was beaten by a group of people on the street who did not like the fact that I was a white guy covering a black high school civil rights march. There's only one thing to say about the beating that's historically significant. There was a photographer there who took a picture. He whispered to me to leave town because that group was coming for me that night at the motel and they would kill me. And they asked for his camera, and he had already taken the roll out and put it in his pocket. So the next day, a picture of me in a suit and tie, sitting on the ground, being, you know, beaten up by this fellow, appeared on the wire services. And I learned much later, this is how strange history goes, that Andrew Young was a theology student in Massachusetts, married, pondering his future, and he saw this photo, and he told his wife, "We have to move south." So you never know what little act of yours might have an effect on somebody else. That's one of the things I think we have to have a certain faith in. We feel existential, completely isolated, yet, as Bobby Kennedy once said in South Africa, the ripples... You never know where the ripples go and who they may affect.
One thing that did cause a huge effect and did have ripples, which in a sense, I suppose, continue to this day, was the Port Huron Statement of 1962. What was the Port Huron Statement?
Port Huron is the name of a town on the border of Michigan and Canada. It was the site of a labor camp owned by the United Auto Workers. When SDS decided we had to have a vision for some reason, we were feeling the need to express ourselves. I was assigned the task of drafting the vision, and it would be circulated with 50 or 100 people. We would meet for a week, and we would adopt it with amendments and discussion. So it was supposed, I think it was supposed to be 10 pages. It turned out to be like 60 pages. It was over the top. It was totally crazy. But we adopted it, and the essence of it was a generational emphasis, which was new on the left. Youth were not a category of social change. It was supposed to be the working class, for example. And so it had a generational call. It was speaking to people our age and speaking to the outer world about what we saw had gone wrong with the arms race on the one hand, the failure to do anything about racism on the other, so on. And the core of it came from our sense of disenfranchisement. The core of it was called participatory democracy. In other words, we thought representative democracy was a token system in which you came out of apathy, you voted once in a while, you sent somebody down to the big house, and they would make decisions, and every 2 years you'd vote again. We wanted a voice in the decisions that affected our lives. This was particularly acute because we were being drafted, but we couldn't vote. Secondly, it arose from the fact that the university sort of pontificated to us, but they didn't dialogue with us. And we were treated in loco parentis, which was Latin for the university being a substitute parent. And so, like a white girl that would have coffee with a black guy in the student union, her parents would receive a phone call, and they'd be put through all this grief. So we were all treated as adolescents, yet we were struggling to become adults. So we wanted a more democratic university in a democratic society. We wanted jobs in the future where we had a meaningful voice. We wanted a foreign policy where citizens mattered. And we drew our inspiration from the student movement in the South, where with their lives on the line, for all you know. Everybody who's going to a demonstration felt they had a right to sit through a meeting to discuss how it was going to go, what was going to be the defense, what were you going to wear, who was going to get the bail, what were the demands. They participated in the decision that was going to impel them into this action that was high risk. So this came loud and clear to us that what was wrong was we had a psychic deficit and a political deficit. We needed to be able to participate in the decisions that affected our lives.
On a personal level, you married very young. You married to a fellow political activist, Sandra Casey. But to what extent were you married to the movement? Were you concentrating on your own needs?
I think I've always been married to the movement. The first marriage, I dearly love that woman, and I still keep track of her. We're in touch. She's living in Arizona. It was kind of a ritual marriage. I guess I thought, the way I was brought up, that after you graduate college, you get married, and you get a car, wife and car. And she was in the civil rights movement. She was a poet. She was an icon. She was a protester. But I wasn't ready for settling down. I just, to this day, I'm embarrassed to say, I just wasn't fit as a husband. I was 20 years old, 21 years old. So what happened is I thought of my own needs. I wanted to come back to graduate school, which meant she had to leave her natural setting, her nest, the South, the Deep South, and come to cold Ann Arbor, Michigan, where there was really nothing for her. So eventually it fell apart, and she returned to the South. She played a very important and honorable role in the first phase of the civil rights movement through the mid-60s.
Now, you, of course, also famously became involved in anti-Vietnam War protests. You became aware of the fact that America was becoming mired in Vietnam. You visited North Vietnam in 1965 and then again in 1967. What did you hope to achieve with those visits? Because they were very, very badly received by many in the USA.
They might have been badly received by some at the time, but actually nobody thinks much about it anymore. I was 25. I was knocking on doors. I had settled into Newark, New Jersey, to the ghetto. And I was trying to build an anti-poverty, pro-civil rights movement of the poor that would be closely integrated with the Southern movement. Our idea was to put aside the Cold War and put poverty and civil rights and democracy at the forefront in America, and eventually elect a government that reflected our hopes and aspirations. When Vietnam started, I paid it no mind. It had been going on a very low level, low visibility, low intensity warfare from the late 50s into the early 60s. We supported Johnson in 64 because he said he would keep us out of the Vietnam War, which was exactly what we wanted, and we didn't want that. And then immediately after his being elected, he introduced us to a new concept that we suspected but needed evidence for, which is that presidents lie. So 150,000 Americans go into Vietnam. And I saw the problem as Vietnam is invading America. We need to stand up for civil rights, for freedom, for expanding the vote, for ending poverty in this richest of all countries. And the last thing we need is to draft young men and send them to fight for freedom 13,000 miles away. One part of the policy was to leave us knowing nothing whatever about the enemy. Faceless Viet Cong, they were called. So I got a call. I was called by historian Stoughton Lind. He had received a call from a communist historian, a Marxist historian, I guess you would say, Herbert Aptecker, who said some of the young people protesting the war and demanding civil rights should open a line of communication and see who the Vietnamese are. So I was asked, and I was ready to go. It was illegal to go with a passport, so we had to find a way to circumvent that. The purpose was to open human contact, to try to determine whether or not Johnson was right in saying that our bombs were never falling on civilian targets. He's lying again. And to knock down the door for American journalists to get in, arguing that, you know, if it's worth enough to spill our blood, certainly freedom of the press should not be suspended. and we needed to convince Hanoi that they should let reporters in. And it gradually did work. Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times got in not long after, and he reported on the front page that civilians were being killed, that it was not just concrete and steel that was being hit by these bombs. And over time, several hundred anti-war activists and reporters and TV crews got into North Vietnam, got into Cambodia, and helped bring the story back, some of it critical, some of it positive, but that's the way it was. It's hard to believe that could have happened, but we launched a war based on a lie, sent 150,000 18-year-olds over, and said that no reporters were allowed.
1968, it was a marquee year for anti-Vietnam War protest. You were in the streets of Chicago while the Democratic Party was choosing Hubert Humphrey as their presidential candidate. How did what should have been a peaceful protest turn into a riot?
Well, this 1968 is where my inner life connected to the outer life. That is, my assimilated life was broken because of the Irish civil rights demonstrations in the North, which happened approximately the time of Chicago. It was a year that has yet to be fully explained by any of the historians, but it included the Tet Offensive, the murder of Dr. King, the murder of Robert Kennedy. These were the people who I thought would get us out of the situation we were in, get us back on track to the early 60s, Port Huron Vision. Czechoslovakia happened. Riots in every American city, shoot-to-kill orders by Mayor Daley. And we were planning a large demonstration based on the model of November 1967 when 100,000 people protested outside the Pentagon, which we thought was exciting. It was nonviolent. Documents later showed that it scared the hell out of the Pentagon. So they thought we were going to do the same thing in Chicago, and they thought the only way to prevent it was by denying us permits to assemble, creating a climate of fear and terror so that nobody would come, not making it possible to have electricity in the park so you couldn't have generators for speeches or music, and so on. It started as anti-war, and it began to be purified into a straightforward confrontation. Would we be scared away by the authorities, or would we stand for the First Amendment by marching in the streets regardless of whether they gave us a permit? So, of course, march became the conclusion. And so it became a kind of a crazy week where at some moments you could march for a while and then you would all be arrested, or you could stay in the park. We were demanding, stay in the park. Don't drive us out into the streets. Let us sleep overnight in the park, which is what the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts do. People do that. And they would come into the park and then gas everybody in the park and then drive them into the streets and then beat them in the streets. 60 or 70 reporters were gassed and beaten. They even beat up poor Dan Rather. I think they belly punched him at inside the convention. Fights broke out on the convention floor. It was hard to tell whether it was overreaction, whether it was lack of discipline, whether it was intentional, and if it was intentional, whether it flowed from a higher authority in the FBI, the secret government, or in the White House. Was it part of a plan by pro-Nixon people to run on a presidential platform of crushing radicalism and restoring law and order? I'm beginning to think that we need to investigate further the classified documents on that score. Anyway, this was for me, this was kind of the end of the Tom Hayden of the early 60s. I had not expected this. I had been beaten up all week and arrested all week, and my original identity that my parents had formed for me so meticulously had been quite broken. You know, the women wanted their part back, the blacks wanted their part back, the Chicanos wanted their identity. Who was I? Apparently an enemy of the state or something. And I remember sitting in somebody's living room and seeing these marchers going to Derry across that road in the north, and I'd never really paid attention to this. And what got me was the identity of what they were going through, the water cannon, the dogs, but most of all, they were singing "We Shall Overcome." This had a transformative effect on a very profound level. First, that there was a global movement. Second, that they were Irish and knew about us, but I was Irish and didn't even know about me or them. And so I immediately began the second phase of my life and went through a kind of reborn experience with all of those complications. So Chicago was more than Chicago. Then we went on to be tried. That took a year and a half. We were found guilty on one charge, not on the other. There were hundreds of riots around the country on the day of our sentencing in February 1970. The Bank of America was burned in Santa Barbara. We were in jail for about 30 days until we could raise bail. Everybody in Cook County Jail was black except us. And shortly thereafter came Kent State and Jackson State, where troops actually did shoot to kill. They had live ammunition. There were in that period, 69 to 71, in there, there were 20 students killed by troops in the United States. It wasn't reported as a number, but we had moved into a dark zone, you know, where they were shooting at unarmed students.
The trial itself was infamous, partly because of the judge, Julius Hoffman. It became kind of Hoffman versus Hoffman because you had Abby Hoffman as one of the accused. You also had Bobby Seale, the Black Panther. Tell me a little bit about some of the things that went on in that courtroom.
Well, first of all, it didn't have to happen. If the Democrats had won the election, it was known that we would not have been indicted and sent to trial. So when Nixon won and we were indicted, it was a signal that this was a political trial. This wasn't about the facts. This would not have happened under one president. It happened under another. Bobby Seale is a good example. Bobby Seale was, you know, part of a very militant group. Black Men Armed was so provocative that it actually triggered more repression. He had been in Chicago for a 15-minute speech and had not been in Chicago longer than a couple of hours before he left. He was included because that spiced up the indictment. You know, we have a Black Panther and so on. And I guess I and Rennie Davis, Dave Dellinger, we were the mobilization against the Vietnam War. And Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, they were the yippies and freaks. And John Wiener and John Freunds were typical of the people drawn into the conspiracy by the Big Five, and so on. Seale had already been indicted on a conspiracy to murder in New Haven, Connecticut. So he was brought to Chicago as a prisoner. He got up every morning at 4 and came to the courtroom. His lawyer, Charles Gary, was sick and wanted a 2-month postponement, denied. Bobby Seale then took the unconventional course, because his life was at stake, ultimately, of demanding to represent himself or be represented by Charles Gary. The judge wouldn't hear anything of it, thought it was a trick of some kind. If it was a trick, the judge certainly played into it. So eventually, the judge, with the FBI's concurrence, actually ordered Bobby Seale to be chained and gagged, that is, taken out of the courtroom, mouth taped with duct tape, chains, symbol of slavery, around his wrist to the chair, carried back in. And, of course, it didn't work. Bobby Seale could still, he could still make noises. So it was ridiculous. But it brought the attention of the world, and certainly all African Americans, to this case. And eventually he was expelled. He was dropped from the case to be dealt with later. And I must add, for the sake of history, that the same thing happened in New Haven. The charges were dropped in both cases and never brought back. So he came out a free man. Anyway, I mean, I didn't see much of it, but I'm told it was on television every day for several months. And that was a mistake. And it just mobilized this mass movement that was anti-war, that was anti the repression of the Panthers, and anti the judge. And little remembered are the hundreds and hundreds of demonstrations. We're talking about riots.
Now, you were someone who was well used to a certain kind of attention and to a certain kind of notoriety. Did that greatly increase when you married Jane Fonda in 1973?
Well, the notoriety about Mary and Jane certainly, yes. I mean, I was a satellite almost to her star in orbit, and we didn't know what we could do about it. It's just, it's difficult. And you wonder, is this what I want? Or is what I want grown so far monstrously out of control that it's not really what I want? We stayed together, we had children, we had a good life, but I was really in this movement, and she was really in the entertainment industry, theater, the arts. And I think gradually when the steam went out of the 60s and the war had ended, those forces within her, those drives within her, materialized again, and she wanted to go back into movies. I just didn't manage it. That was not what I wanted. And yet, I hardly disrespected or despised it. That's fine. But it's as if she rematerialized as what she was 10 years before. And I mean, I rematerialized the way I was and am, which is, with some notable derailments here and there, pretty much the same as I've been for 55 years. So I think of it as a natural dissolution of the marriage after about 18 years.
You're opposed to the war in Iraq. Now, leaving aside the effects of the two affected nations, do you see Iraq as being more or less destructive from an American point of view than the Vietnam conflict?
Well, Vietnam was more destructive. 58,000 Americans dead, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands wounded, a couple million people from Indochina killed, millions displaced. There's no comparison. What is interesting is that the war in Iraq, and I've been teaching a course about it and writing about it, has reignited an anti-war movement and anti-war sentiment quite rapidly, despite the fact that they've tried to avoid triggering an anti-war movement. There's no draft. College students are comfortable. The war doesn't cost any money. It's paid off in supplemental appropriations, future generations. And the casualties, while horrific individually, are 4,000 Americans, including contractors, 22,000 wounded, which is about 1/15 of Vietnam. So we have this phenomenon, which I call the Iraq syndrome, which replaced that very progressive Vietnam syndrome, that cautionary consciousness that emerged after Vietnam. And this Iraq syndrome has expressed itself in 8 demonstrations of over 100,000 people. 2 or 3 of them, probably 500,000 people. 165 or 175 city councils issuing resolutions against the war. The Gallup poll showing that a majority of Americans turned against Iraq faster than they turned against Vietnam. The explosion of the internet, I mentioned MoveOn members giving $180 million. How about that Michael Moore movie, Fahrenheit 9/11? There was one poll I saw, for what it's worth, that said a majority of Americans intended to see that movie. I mean, that's far from the underground press of the 1960s.
You're Tom Hayden, father.
Grandfather.
Grandfather. Even better.
I am indeed.
You're Tom Hayden, father and grandfather, one of your kids, Troy Garrity, with a very promising movie career. Did you get a chance through all of this activity, to enjoy the kids when they were growing up?
Absolutely. I'm a fool for children. I have a new one. His name is Liam Jack Diallo Hayden. He's a 7-year-old, and I'm thinking now of escaping L.A. and taking a 7-year-old fishing this weekend, especially now that I'm retired. I don't belong to any institution. I've always made time, and then let's not forget Vanessa, who was a stepdaughter who came before I knew Jane. She's off in Atlanta. She's a documentary filmmaker. Troy's an actor. And Liam is just a well-adjusted young man.
You've been at this now for nearly 50 years. You're director of No More Sweatshops. You're still involved in activism. Do you not think it's time to tend the flowers, go fishing, and let the current crop of 20-somethings in on the act?
Well, I don't know about tending the flowers, but letting somebody else take over, I already do that. I mean, I'm not running for office anymore. I have no aspiration to lead or administer any organizations. I kind of orient my activity to the younger generation while using what connections I still have to make a contribution. And I teach. I research. I write one or two books every year, year and a half. I'm writing a big book on movements versus Machiavellians, a kind of summing up. There's a Tom Hayden reader coming out from City Lights Books later this year. I've just written a short book on Iraq that's out now. On sweatshops, I advise the city of L.A. and San Francisco and younger activists, and I sit on advisory committees. On the issue of gangs, I've written a book, and I spend a lot of time trying to advocate for ex-gang members to be treated with respect and provided jobs. So I think there's a way to be the old man and be relevant, because I can bring something to bear in writing about globalization and about Iraq. I can open some doors to Congress and politics. But knowing my place is to build a bridge to encourage the current and future generation is the important thing. And when I was young, I thought the crisis was, it was always called a youth crisis. Remember, generation. But I think it's really an elders crisis. It's how the 60s generation finds its way to be supportive of and loving of and a backbone for the 90s and for the generation of the 21st century. I was told by my doctor, that despite having heart surgery a few years ago, that on average I'm going to live 10 or 15 years older than my own father. I might live 30 years. So I'm in a state of shock currently. Should I be fading into the twilight, or is this the birth of a new day? And what do you do when you're a 75-year-old with 20 years to give? So it's like a fourth act rather than a three act. I thought it was just young, middle age, old. Yet the complaint of young people to get out of the way is a complaint that I hear loud and clear.